Welcome, everybody, to this edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. November is here, but the same focal points from last month were center of attention on this 11th match day of the season. The Premier League's new darling Jurgen Klopp posted his first league victory, while our ex-boyfriend Jose Mourinho was tight-lipped after Chelsea's sixth loss of the campaign. At the top of the table, Manchester City and Arsenal increased their leads over the field, albeit slightly, while Manchester United's scoreless run reached 305 minutes with a draw at Selhurst Park. To talk about that, West Ham stumble, and Everton's Sunday explosion, I welcome my co-host, Lawrence McKenna. And Lawrence, on this rare occasion that you and I are having a tandem pod, it's probably apt that we start with Liverpool.
Please don't call it that.
we're a duo today instead of a threesome.
This sounds like something you do at a rest stop.
Let's not do this. This is particularly given Kartik just traveled the length of Florida, tons of rest stops in Florida.
No one wants to think about that. Yeah.
But Kartik Krishnire is in Northern Florida today in Jacksonville for the Fort Lauderdale Strikers' last game of the NASL season. They win today. They're in the playoffs. It won't be the last game of their season. But let's talk about your team, Lawrence. 3-1 win at Stamford Bridge. A lot of talk about Jose Mourinho. Let's leave that for the back part of this first segment. Let's talk about the positive. Jurgen Klopp got his first league win, the first multi-goal game for Liverpool since he took over. And it was particularly notable because they fell behind after 4 minutes and still came back and really were somewhat decisively the better side on Saturday.
Yeah. There's the great positivity around Liverpool, which is that the pressing worked on a number of players. There's a good formational sense out there. Coutinho got his goals that obviously prove that he's not the terrible player that everyone thinks his form would suggest. other such things, such as Sakho and Skrtel having Diego Costa fairly under control for the whole game. Not that Moreno or Klein were caught out of position a number of times during the match, or that Lucas probably should have been sent off. Hmm. And then, obviously, the win is tapered by all those negative and positive factors. And then also the fact that Chelsea just looked to go to bits, apart from a couple of players in that dressing room who, I mean, arguably the only player who played or looked to play as if he was at full volume was Willian.
I thought Costa was okay. I want to give credit to Sakho and Skrtel there. Costa maybe isn't in the same form that he was the last couple of years, but he's still moving, he's still trying, he's still getting into spaces. We see other players like Azpilicueta seems okay. He definitely was more than okay on Chelsea's goal. But I tend to agree with you. This is the same story every week for Chelsea, where we're looking player for player and kind of just shrugging our shoulders. Even though Fabregas was dropped this weekend, it just doesn't look like a team that has the talent anymore to compete for the league title, maybe for a top four. And we always hear this list now of players, Lawrence, that, oh, the De Bruynes and the Matas that Mourinho has given up on. But even this weekend, we saw Romelu Lukaku play very well on Sunday, and then Ryan Bertrand is coming back too. There are a number of players around the league and around Europe now that you look at and you see they could really, really do something at Chelsea right now.
It's true. I mean, you probably could make a whole team of players that Mourinho has pissed off along the way or, you know, done something like that too. But then you'd also say there's a whole team of players that Mourinho has ignited along the way as well. Mm. So it swings and roundabouts, really, isn't it, with what you get with Mourinho? And I think that that's also part of the nature of his management, is that his management is very immediate. And so he doesn't, or what most people's approach to Mourinho's management necessitates is immediacy. Mm. So it means that they go, come in and give us good results. And he goes, okay, well, I'm going to need to get rid of these guys then. And they go, okay, fair enough. And then they get those results. That means that they don't have the long term necessarily. And then they are angry because of that.
Especially when you inherit a veteran team that had already been challenging for titles for so long. Let's talk about some of the changes he made today. Finally, somebody benches a star player. Cesc Fabregas moved to the bench. Oscar back in the team.
So, I thought you meant Benteke. Sorry.
No, I was actually alluding to Rooney there. Let's go ahead and put that off for another segment, though.
That's awkward. That's three managers then who have benched someone who's a star player. And that was also a huge piece of contention for Trevor Francis on the BT commentary in England.
Really?
He was so confused as to why Liverpool couldn't start Christian Benteke. And after Chelsea scored after 4 minutes, I think the line was almost literally, he'll have to change something now. And you're like, it's been 4 minutes, Trevor.
And I don't think Firmino was really that bad in that role. And I really liked some of the movement when you ended up with Lallana across the defense, sometimes Coutinho dropping in there. It seemed fine. And I think the final score somewhat supports that.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think the point would be, if you spend $32 million on a player, then, there's going to be question marks when he doesn't play. But at the same time, you'd probably say, Trevor, I'm not sure you're qualified to talk about this at this point. And I'd imagine that a guy who's been watching them in training all week probably is. And then Benteke came on and fitted in perfectly. The notes of vindication coming out of BT at that point were incredible. Mm. But at the same time, you say, well, that's what an impact sub does.
Let's also give it a couple more weeks, because Benteke might not be at 90 minutes fit. At least we should give Klopp and his staff the benefit of the doubt on that. And even so, it's not so outrageous to see the Liverpool team that was put out there and think that that wasn't justified for some reason.
I feel the same way about the reactions to Origi and other people like that. Week after week, it's just people who are indignant, looking for something to be indignant about.
Well,
I think
we should probably talk about Felipe Coutinho then, because he had one very good goal. He did the main work on the second goal that took a healthy deflection off John Terry. Mm-hmm. Other than that, he wasn't that impactful. But this really is Felipe Coutinho, that you have him in the team. He's going to go through spells like the whole first half today until stoppage time, where he doesn't seem to have much of an impact. But then he can do something very special. I guess what probably annoys you, Lawrence, and annoys me a little bit about it is that if you look at the special moments, you're going to think he's a world-class player. And if you look at the bad moments, you're going to think he's a crap player. But he's actually not even somewhere in between. He's something a little bit closer to the former.
I get the feeling that it's almost reverting to the mean with him sometimes, that he's an incredibly good technical player, and you need good confidence to be able to pull that off. And very often that's great, because that can be ignited by a manager who is able to bring that out of him. But at the same time, sometimes the system doesn't require you to hold on to the ball for a long time, mm-hmm. or to make jinking runs or to do something that's genius. It actually just requires you to pick it up and then move it on. And that is sort of the nature of what a lot of managers maybe should be asking of him in the position that he plays at Liverpool, is when you get the ball in that 10 role, pick it up, bring it forward a little bit, and then pass it on to someone else and expect to be part of a move. But I guess it's also part of the nature of the way that he plays and where he plays and how he plays that people think, well, if he's not, dropping, shouldering and pass someone, then he's not doing what he should be doing. Hmm. So I see what you mean, but what I have enjoyed out of him over the last 2 weeks is his physicality in the game and his want and drive to be able to get back for the ball and get between players. I especially enjoy the way that Liverpool don't necessarily tackle right now. They get between the player and the ball, mm-hmm. and it's apart from Lucas. But he literally just gets between the player. But that's what I find quite satisfying, is the way that Liverpool are tackling, in inverted commas. Because it's almost like watching a game of FIFA. You don't actually have to go to ground. You have to sort of press B as much as you can, or A, and you just pull on their shirt a little bit until you get the ball.
Mm-hmm. Or you jump in the passing lane between the player and the obvious pass that's going to happen.
And it's satisfying to watch.
Yeah. I think the thing with Coutinho, and I think everybody tends to dwell on him a little bit when they watch him, is that he's obviously a player that's still adjusting to how Klopp wants people to play, just like everybody else is adjusting to. And so he has moments where he does float a little bit, maybe with that number 10's mentality that you're talking about. But in that way, I find it a very interesting compliment between him and Adam Lallana right now, where maybe Lallana is a little bit too in overdrive all the time. I think we saw that Zuma maybe felt the brunt of one overdrive moment where he just got plowed into by Lallana. Both of those players maybe can adjust their games a little bit. But what are we, 6 games into the Klopp era? I think there's, as Klopp said midweek, a lot of positives. Let's talk about Chelsea. You mentioned Lucas. One of Jose Mourinho's few things that he would say after the match dwelt on Lucas potentially should have been sent off. To what extent do you agree with that?
Yeah, fascinating. Did you win the game? No. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, there's a number of people's analysis out there that say, the game pivoted on that, Jose, not the terrible performances that multiple numbers of your players put in.
Yes.
Do you want to flip the coin and go with what Diego Costa tried to do with his leg?
And that's something that nobody seems to be talking about, that he should have gotten red carded for kicking Martin Skrtel. And the official was right there too. It's almost as if his Skrtel had made more out of it, and Skrtel seemed to not want to play into the Costa thing that got Gabriel sent off earlier this year. If Skrtel had actually gone back at Costa, Costa might have been red carded for that. Instead, Skrtel downplaying it made it seem like it was more innocuous than it was.
But it's also the immediacy of what happened, because Mikel got a yellow card for something that seemed like it would have been let go if it was Liverpool, whereas the other way around. But there's also the point would be there. Mourinho sometimes asks his players to do certain things, and then when it sort of swings the opposite way, when we're surprised that players aren't diving, then he's indignant about that. Yeah. So I think it swings and roundabouts again for him.
Let's come back to Mourinho in a second, because let's actually spend a couple of minutes talking about what Chelsea did on the field. We alluded to it before. Fabregas was dropped, although he did come on late. He was actually on the field for both the winning and the essentially insurance goals for Liverpool. Oscar was back in the team on the left. Eden Hazard was through the middle. Eden Hazard got pulled very early in the second half. What are your thoughts on what Mourinho is trying to do with Chelsea right now? It seems like he's trying to tweak a little bit, but then some of the things like, pulling Eden Hazard early, how does that really help the team in the long run not to really try to get Eden Hazard back to his top form?
Yeah, I mean, you would say it's not only just what he does on the pitch to get Hazard back to top form, and maybe part of it is Eden Hazard's understanding of what his role is within the team, and if he's not going to try and perform that at all, then maybe he is better off the pitch.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You would also say that it was maybe, who was the substitute for? Sorry, I actually don't remember who Hazard was subbed off for.
I think it was Kennedy. Was that Kennedy at that point?
Kennedy. Yeah, I think it was, yeah. Let me just make sure. Yeah, it's Kennedy who he came off for. And then, Mourinho didn't make another substitution for another 10 minutes after that. And you'd say Kennedy did look like he was driving at Liverpool's back line as much as Kennedy is able to do in a very different way to the way that Hazard was going to do. I just think, when it comes down to that, it seems like it's more speculation around Mourinho's management than the actual effect of Hazard. And actually, he was just another day, if Chelsea are winning and he'd been fairly, say Chelsea had taken that 1-0 in the end, or it had been 2-1 to Chelsea, or Lucas had, been sent off or whatever, then maybe we'd be saying, well, he was looking to change it in a slightly different way, and we read that slightly differently.
Yeah, I think we're starting to see why Eden Hazard has never been a huge factor for the Belgian national team. He's been great for Lille and he's been great for Chelsea, and we've always looked at his international record and kind of scratched our head. But there is this side to Eden Hazard where when it doesn't click or he doesn't have the right place in your team, then he's going to look, I don't want to say ordinary, but he's going to look like a talented player who's always underperforming. Let's go ahead and talk
about...
A
little bit spoiled. Well, you feel he's almost spoiled by that. He looks spoiled, if we put it that way. Hmm. But then is it that we transpose really unattractive qualities onto multiple Mourinho wingers and talented players? No one liked Robin when he was in England because he looked like a constantly just horrible person.
Yeah.
And he's, it's the same with Hazard.
But I think it's also when you see a player like Willian in the team, and I think the one thing I think of when I think of Willian is that he always just seems to be working. It's very hard not to extrapolate those kind of puritanical values in a way onto Hazard and just go, well, if you're not scoring goals, at least try to be like Willian in some way. And Oscar too. Oscar is a player who always seems to have a small impact, even if he's not setting up or scoring goals. So Hazard maybe...
It's funny though, two Brazilians who...
Yeah, interesting. Ramirez too. Throw Ramirez in there too.
Yeah, I think it is there's different analysis depending on the continent that people come from.
Interesting.
And Hazard should be hardworking because he's European and comes from a country.
Well, I think it's not so much that. I think it's more like if you're not contributing in other ways, you at least need to put forth the effort to make up for it. But then again, as you allude to, and I think more broadly, we tend to think that all players should be a certain way. And just because Eden Hazard's best features aren't coming through right now doesn't mean he should have to develop new features. I think that's upon him and the coach together to come up with something that works.
That's actually a really good suggestion, Richard.
it's a great suggestion. If it were that easy, then we would have seen it happen more often.
Top notes for Monday morning: to develop new features. Brilliant. Okay.
Trying to program a player for like FM16 or something like that. Let's go ahead and tip our hat to the obligatory Mourinho post-match interview. If you saw it with BT, he basically declined to answer all the questions, giving slightly different variations on no or I can't answer the whole time. I think there were 8 questions total, and none of Mourinho's responses really went beyond 8 words. I think this is incredibly interesting, Lawrence, because a lot of people are portraying this as Mourinho petulance or Mourinho being kind of a sore loser. To me, this is a function also of the FA fining managers for being honest after the game. And granted, a lot of that honesty is incredibly biased, but this is what happens. If you don't want managers to say be honest after the game, if you're going to fine them for being honest, then you also have to live with the possibility that a manager is going to start to forego these post-match interviews, whether it be explicitly by sending Gary Cahill to the microphone or explicitly by showing up on camera and then saying nothing.
Yes, it's about freedom of speech, I guess. And if we're indignant to maybe the I use the word indignant a lot. If we're angry about the Man City fans being fined for their booing, but we're not angry about Mourinho being fined for expressing his opinion on whatever it is, then maybe there's a double standard there. And I think I've probably been critical of him for having got a referee in the past. But I'd say it's also different the way that you choose to criticize a referee. Mm. I think sometimes his criticism does go too far or is based on something that you'd argue looks paranoid. Whereas it may have actually been a time where it would have been a good time to talk about maybe some of the decisions the referees have made. Mm. And I think, you know, you're right in what you say. I don't think that the FA is right in fining managers for what they have fined them for. At the same time, I think Mourinho is hiding behind that now. And the problem is BT are almost happy with that because it gives them something to put up on the website and go, look at this awful interview that we've got. And people are happy to look at that. So it becomes part of the, well, they've clicked it, so people must want to see it, you know, category that it goes in.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to keep talking about Mourinho, Chelsea, finding new reasons to do so. But odds are Jose Mourinho is still going to be with us next weekend, despite all the stories that were in the papers Sunday morning. We'll talk about that a little bit more after the break. But first, let's get you up to date on the action in the 8 other games this weekend in the Premier League, starting on Saturday, where Arsenal, again, scoring in bunches in the second half, got goals from Olivier Giroud, Lauren Koscielny, and Joel Campbell, posting a 3-0 win at Swansea City. Newcastle had 2 good chances to break their deadlock with Stoke City, but ultimately were held 0-0 at St. James's Park. Watford took advantage of an Andy Carroll error for the opening goal and got a second from Odion Ighalo en route to a 2-0 win over visiting West Ham. Leicester got 2 goals from Riyad Mahrez and a score for the 8th game in a row from Jamie Vardy in a 3-2 win at West Brom. Palace nearly broke through in the second half, but were still kept up a 0-0 with visiting Manchester United, while Manchester City overcame a late Joe Hart error with a Yaya Toure penalty conversion in their 2-1 win over Norwich City. On Sunday, Sunderland's Tyne Wear highs were short-lived as Everton routed the Black Cats with 4 straight goals at the end of a 6-2 win at Goodison Park, and Southampton finished the weekend with a very Saints-like 2-0 win over visiting Bournemouth. Ahead of tomorrow's Spurs Villa match, Manchester City is still top of the table, with goal difference separating them from Arsenal. Leicester moves into third place as Man United stumbles into fourth, with West Ham's loss keeping them 1 point out of the top 4. A win on Monday by Tottenham, and they'll claim West Ham's spot. At the bottom, Newcastle's point leaves them only 1 from safety, with Sunderland 1 point back of them. Aston Villa would leapfrog both clubs with a win at White Hart Lane. When we come back, we'll focus on Mourinho and the rest of the contenders at the top of the table. But first, I want to talk to you about our sponsor, Rabble.tv. So what exactly is Rabble.tv? Well, it's a new place, one where you can listen to live match commentaries from real fans while games are being played. And the way it works is pretty simple. All you have to do is tune into your game, but then press the mute button on your television or in your browser, then head over to Rabble.tv to listen to soccer fans providing their own call. Or better yet, you can create your own broadcast and call one of your team's games just by signing up for free and switching on your microphone. You can listen to a broadcast on your desktop, through your iOS app, and now through your mobile browser. You can call your favorite matches or get involved with your friends and develop your own regular programming. Every day, people are finding new ways to use the platform.
So especially Kartik.
Especially Kartik, yes.
Mm.
So Kartik, every Thursday, has his Divers and Cheats show, just like a number of other people have developed their regular shows. And it's really easy to promote it to. It's a great show. A lot of people listen to it. You can hear all the interaction to it. It's a really good example of what you can do on this platform. And anybody can do it. All you need is a browser and a microphone. So go over to Rabble.tv today, check it out, and sign up. Because at Rabble.tv, it's your team, and it's your call. Well, Lawrence, let's jump back into the Jose Mourinho debate for a little bit. I want to spend most of this segment talking about the other teams at the top of the table, but it seems like every week we go through this, at least for the last 4 or 5 weeks, Chelsea with a poor result and the speculation about him being sacked. What do you think, Lawrence? Do you think we're any closer to Chelsea changing their manager than we were a month ago?
Time-wise?
Yes, technically, we all move forward and Mourinho will not manage Chelsea forever.
Yes. You may be wrong, Richard. I think, yes, we probably have, because that result against Liverpool again showed that there are problems within the club, and there are some fairly obvious things. The problem is it's become so obvious now, hasn't it? It's not like it's sort of, you know, just a couple of games. It's kind of a long string of those sorts of things. But there was also, you know, the opening goal was, I think that's what the problem with was for me, that I'm also questioning a lot Liverpool's identity at the moment and the second coming of someone there. And you sort of think, what's been ignited within those players? I think that's part of the problem, is we realised how fragile the confidence in Mourinho was, that opening goal made Chelsea look like, wow, you know, oh, wait, no, we do know how to play football, you know? And he can still motivate us because it bought end product from Ramirez. But then when Liverpool began to come back, then it crumbled again.
Well, did they talk about this on BT's broadcast? Because here in the States,
I lost interest and just tuned into the American one. Sorry.
Okay, well, then you heard here in the States, there was a lot of dwelling on Chelsea seemingly changing tactics after Mikel missed what was basically a sitter after, I believe it was John Terry headed down that William restart for across the goal to him. But
yeah.
We saw it a lot of times from Chelsea last year where they were very content to do this, to sit on a lead and eventually go 2-3 up through counterattacking. And there were a couple of points in the first half where you really thought Chelsea's counterattack might be back a little bit. But
Other teams were bad, though, Richard. That's not because that relied very often on other teams leaving themselves open. Mm-hmm. And the problem was they came up against a team who were the antithesis of what Chelsea represent right now.
Mm. Well, I think in that sense, we have to give credit to Liverpool.
Yes, exactly. Well, yeah. And also credit to Klopp, because you'd say if you'd have read that team sheet under Rodgers, maybe it would have felt different.
Because Emery Chan would have been playing in defense.
Well, that would have also meant a back three, you're right, Richard.
Right.
But it would have also meant, you know, that we would have seen a couple of players who maybe were discontented under Rodgers, such as Mamadou Sakho. You definitely would have not seen the name Alberto Moreno on that form, and maybe not even Firmino. And maybe not even Benteke, I don't know.
But you mentioned like reading into decisions, talking about the viability of managers, and I just get the feeling with the Mourinho thing. With every loss, we have another column about how Mourinho's closer to being sacked, and obviously all the questions, most of the questions from BT Sport had to do with that, or at least tried to link up with that. I just feel like we're treading water with this, Lawrence, because we don't have any solid reporting from the reporting on the higher-ups of Chelsea saying that Mourinho is any closer to losing his job. In fact,
what do you mean, Richard, come on. We got that BBC report today which said that someone in the dressing room would rather lose for him than win for him.
Someone, huh? So it could be Loic Remy, it could be John Terry. Who is it exactly? Do we know?
They're both just as influential players. I think we know that.
It's a little harsh, but actually maybe...
On Loic.
Well, yeah, maybe Terry's influence is a negative influence at this point. But I'm just getting really frustrated by this story, Lawrence, because in the past with Chelsea, we have had good reporters, be it somebody like Dominic Feifeld at The Guardian or somebody like Duncan Castles, who's very connected with Chelsea and Mourinho, report on things from Chelsea when things are about to happen. Throughout this whole month plus of speculation around Mourinho, we haven't gotten those clues. Instead, we've gotten public declarations from Chelsea saying that Mourinho is going to be around. And this week, we got reporting saying that the higher-ups at Chelsea were acknowledging that the recruitment this summer was lacking. So I'm just wondering how long we're going to spin this Mourinho about to be sacked thing. It makes sense in terms of the results, but it doesn't make sense in terms of the reporting.
Yeah, I think reporters are slightly confused as to what to say. I mean, you know, Mourinho does confuse people with the things that he says week in, week out. And I think it became somewhat of a tactic for stalling for wait. I think Mourinho was somewhat stalling for time on wait for me to get it right. But in the meantime, I'm just going to tell you really confusing stuff because that means that, you know, you don't quite know what to say.
And then when I get it right, I look like at all.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's become a very common thing for some managers to do, is to say very kind of obtrusive things and sort of be like, just give me time, you know? And I think that is now beginning to work against Mourinho, because again, people are getting frustrated with him.
Hmm. Interesting.
It seems fairly straightforward in that sense.
Yeah, and they're having to fill the gap with these stories or variations of the same stories. And I don't want to make it sound like it's only about the people that are writing the stories, because it does make sense on a certain level that when you see certain pieces fall in a row, you want to write about the things that historically have followed. And to be honest, people want more stories about Mourinho. There is a big thirst. There always has been a big thirst for Jose Mourinho related content. And in this
but
way,
I disagree with these. If accurate stories, then they would not be the thirst. But no, the problem is there's such a dearth of inaccurate stories that therefore...
Or speculative stories. Not inaccurate, speculative. Let's say that.
I mean, the speculation very often can lead to inaccuracy. We've both read Caught Offside. So, you know...
I have not.
That's not a dig at all their writers. Some of them are excellent people. But, you know, some just decide to copy and paste things. And, you know, that's the nature of churnalism. I don't think anyone is going to be mortally offended by the fact that someone points out that you churn things as opposed to... you know, find things.
Right.
It's pointing out a fact, you know. But it's just that maybe in football, people... the ultimate irony here would be, and this is what I've been at odds with this weekend, is how much of football analysis is just mansplaining things to other men?
A lot. Or
exactly.
I guess I also feel about this about social media too. Sometimes we're not saying what we feel or where the information is pointing. We're saying what we think would fit the platform and the tone without regard for the actual accuracy of it. We're just saying things that we think people want to hear in the moment. I think one thing that came to mind this weekend when watching David De Gea is back in the days when David De Gea came over from Atletico, and there was that big rush from all the people in me. It's like, oh, he's so poor coming out for balls, needs to improve this, needs to improve that. And it turns out that David De Gea maybe can be a very successful goalkeeper without buying into all that conventional wisdom. And sometimes with the punditry and on social media, we only get the conventional wisdom and not actual thoughtful analysis based on the information that we have.
Depending on who you follow.
This is true. I mean, if you follow us, you only get 100% cogent, well-reasoned. Never mind. I'm remembering some of my tweets from yesterday.
Yeah,
but
can't bother with that, yeah.
Let's move on to the other teams at the top of the table. Part of the reason we're taking this much time with Mourinho, as we always do, is because the results for the other contenders at the top of the table, there's not a lot in them, to use a Britishism. For example, Arsenal's 3-0 win over Swansea, Lawrence. We've seen this result over the last few weeks from Arsenal. It's very impressive on one level. On another level, their goals are coming in bunches. So they're kind of flipping the switch when they want to, which can be both persuasive, if you want to view it like, wow, look at how high their highs are, and then a little bit worrying if you're worried about better teams that can take advantage of those times when their switch is not flipped. Regardless, another multi-goal win on the road, and they're still even on points at the top of the table.
Yeah, and also all the goals coming. Weirdly, there have been a couple of results like this where they've had a very poor first half, in which most people who analyze Arsenal go...
The result this seems to be identical.
Yeah, but in which time most people go, well, the other team played well in that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, or the general thing you'll see on Arsenal fan channel, not that there are many of them, but they'll say, well, we made them look good, which is taking utter responsibility for making someone look good.
Yeah.
So you still get a slight sense of feeling good about yourself, despite the fact that you made someone else look good because you were bad.
Well, I felt that Norwich actually did play well. I thought this game was just kind of a bad game for the first half.
Fair enough.
Maybe a little harsh, but you kind of get what I'm saying in the contrast between the two performances.
Completely. But I also see the positives for Arsenal here, and I think the positives are Giroud, and obviously the scoring of the goal for everyone. The guy that everyone wanted to score just because they like him is Joel Campbell. Mm-hmm. I think there was a collective just breathing out for him, and I think everyone was very happy for him that he managed to do that in the end.
I'm just remembering he took that extra touch, and maybe against another team, that touch onto his other foot would have cost him.
No, yeah, again, a good point. But also, the question was also, you know, do you move someone like Santi Cazorla up there? But then I think that's part of it, is that people are completely overlooking what Arsene Wenger has done there, which is you know, the great form of Santi Cazorla that we're seeing,
mm-hmm.
and the position that he's playing, which wasn't always the position he played for Arsenal.
Or anywhere else for that matter.
Good point. Yeah, and just his adaptation into, I mean, we've seen some good deep play from Cazorla, and, you know, we've seen it within a couple of isolated situations where maybe he was called upon to do that, and it was never seen as a long-term role for him, but I think it's become a role which makes the whole team look much stronger.
If you want to hear a really effusive and kind of persuasive evaluation of Santi Cazorla, Sid Lowe has a podcast that he does every week called the Spanish Football Podcast. And on the last one I listened to, he was just effusive about Cazorla, admitted that he was higher on Cazorla than anybody else's, but also likened him as a potential successor to Xavi for the Spanish national team because of the skill and the way that he can set tempo and the way they create in the middle of the park. And it was really interesting because that's just not the Santi Cazorla that we have grown to know for Arsenal, but over the course of the last year plus that he's been playing this role, he has been somewhat persuasive, I think. Let's move
on. And then how good Mesut Ozil looks ahead of Cazorla. So
yeah, and Michael Cayley, after talking about him last week, he wrote something for us this week, and he really highlighted how Ozil, Sanchez, and Coquelin have performed this year. And Sanchez and Ozil, to me, were also very, very good this weekend.
One thing I would add on Michael Cayley is I had someone bring me up who's a statistician himself, and he said they like the work that Michael Cayley is doing. Just to give a bit more context that I was unable to give last week, they said they like the work that Michael Cayley is doing. However, they feel it is based on too small a sample size for the arguments that he's making.
Well,
and so if there was a larger sample, they believe that it would become a more accurate model.
Yeah,
although that's the case with every bloody statistician model, isn't it?
It actually is. I would say the one thing I would say in Michael's defense is that he's not saying that Arsenal will do this. He's saying that Arsenal, to base this on the Arsenal argument, he's saying that based on the first 10, 11 matches of performance, Arsenal is performing in a way that's historically consistent with X and Y. So, of course, if the sample size increases, but if you actually look at Michael's work, he actually concedes that it's just, you know, something that you can caveat every single tweet with. And I would encourage people to go to the site, and because he really also breaks down how tactically Arsene Wenger has adjusted a little bit to kind of get the most out of Francis Coquelin. Let's move on to Manchester City Norwich. I don't think there's much in this one also, Lawrence, although...
Why should you say that?
Well, because Norwich started with five at the back, sat back the whole time, were outshot something like 21-5. Manchester City broke through early in the second half. Joe Hart let Norwich back in, and then Raheem Sterling drawing a penalty late gave the match to City. I just don't think there's much to learn from this game. If you set up with five at the back, sit very deep, let Manchester City play with the ball, yeah, you are probably increasing your chances to get a result if you are in Norwich City, but you're not really telling us very much about the likelihood of you improving as a team going forward, nor are you forcing Manchester City to tell us very much about themselves.
No, good point, but then that's not your role. Your role is to get a result from the game.
Right, right.
And, you know, so if effectively, I'd say that I quite enjoyed the way that Norwich approached this game.
It was good viewing, but it just doesn't make for entertaining analysis. Like, we could try to make some deep analytical point about this game, but this game is not something that is going to inform us how likely Manchester City is to claim this year's title.
Yeah, no, good point. Well, I mean, maybe, because it can bring out the old cliche, Richard, of... they managed to scrape out a win here.
Yeah, but did you not expect them to scrape out a win before this game if Norwich City went to this?
Yeah, although the point there would also be with Norwich. If you look at their fixtures more recently, then just not to have a blowout in a game is maybe a good thing for them.
I completely agree. With the way that they had been defending recently, particularly the Newcastle game, this was almost kind of like a moral victory of sorts.
Yeah, although they'd had two, I'd say, pretty decent results in a row. One against Everton, obviously, during the week in the Carling Cup, which I think is definitely a morale booster.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the one the week before against West Brom, where they lost 1-0. But ultimately, that's much better than and is good for recovering from a result like the Newcastle one. Although before that, then you'd say there were some fairly memorable moments for them where they'd won against Bournemouth. They won against West Brom, and they'd also managed to put some good performances in, but nothing. I think when we said this on the podcast, nothing that meant that it looked like they were going to stay up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I was kind of encouraged by the pragmatism of starting in such a defensive way against City and almost looking to frustrate them.
They're in 16th place right now, only 2 points above the drop. I still like them to stay up, and I think it's probably worth more talking to a team like Bournemouth right now than Norwich, but we'll get to Bournemouth eventually. Let's talk about Crystal Palace and Manchester United to the extent that we can talk about anything from this game. Crystal Palace got very good performances from their wide midfielders, Yannick Bolasie, Wilfried Zaha, eventually forming Matteo Darmian off. Very inept performance. Manchester United only had 5 shots all game. Palace had 10. It just seems like the quintessential 2015-2016 Manchester United performance.
That was great. It was, although you'd also say then, you know, Palace did very well and probably should have gone on to win the game.
Particularly in the second half. First half, maybe Manchester United had slightly better of the chances, but in the second half, it definitely looked like Palace was more likely to get a goal than United.
Yeah, limited chances. There was a whole thread today of Manchester United fans just saying, and it's wonderful revisionism. I'm convinced that Sir Alex Ferguson wanted to sell Wayne Rooney. I'm just convinced to the point where he didn't.
You can't blame Manchester United fans for reaching towards any thin thread at this point to not have to just say over and over again, Wayne Rooney is terrible, Wayne Rooney is terrible, because Wayne Rooney is terrible. I mean, Kartik said a couple weeks ago they thought Cesc Fabregas was the worst player in the Premier League. And we had a writer a couple weeks ago also say they thought Wayne Rooney was the worst player in the Premier League this year. I think that writer is winning out right now. Wayne Rooney is really unconscionably terrible. I say unconscionably because he shouldn't be playing.
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem. But would you also say I felt somewhat of a brotherhood alongside those fans, because I almost felt sorry for them that they felt that they had to go to that extent to pull for something like that, which was basically, I almost wanted to tweet and sort of say, it's okay to say he's bad. Like, it's all right to say, as fans, we're disappointed by your performance. You're not a bad supporter for saying you did bad today. Like, you almost, like, as a fan, you almost want to be there. You almost want to always give what you imagine their father would say to them, which would be, you didn't play well today, but I still think you can.
I wonder if Wayne Rooney deep down does think he still has it in him.
Whether he wants to. But again, there's no evidence to suggest either way, so I'm not going to try and comment on that. But what I would say is, it's confusing to see someone who everyone talks about as this master, because it's so at odds with the analysis of Louis van Gaal, which, you know, he doesn't suffer fools, he doesn't like people who don't try for it, he doesn't like people who aren't part of the cause, and like all those kind of things, and he's a master tactician. But he's starting Wayne Rooney.
Yes, and I think that's where the discussion needs to go. We don't need to discuss whether Wayne Rooney is bad anymore. There's really no discussion to be had there. We need to discuss why Louis van Gaal keeps going in this direction. And while that's all speculation because we don't know what's inside the mind of Louis van Gaal, thank God, there's probably some very gross stuff in there. What we do know is that Wayne Rooney, beyond all explanation, continues to start and Manchester United has options. I just don't see it, Lawrence. I don't see any reason for it. The one thing that I contrived in my mind as I was watching the game is that Louis van Gaal doesn't feel like on a kind of a club cultural level that he can just bench Wayne Rooney. So what he has to do is play out this game where Wayne Rooney essentially benches himself. Wayne Rooney makes the case with his play that he cannot be on the field. And then once he starts to be benched because of that, then Louis van Gaal can push forward. But until that happens, maybe he feels like it's just too sensitive culturally within the club to bench Wayne Rooney and create this fiasco sideshow that could derail their season.
I suppose at that point, you also look at the bench that they had the other day, which basically offered them the option of Marouane Fellaini, Lingard, or Ashley Young to push Martial more tight.
And then the tweet was, and this was during the Middlesbrough game, Wayne Rooney is literally the worst person on this bench. And not only does Wayne Rooney get in the game, he ends up missing the first penalty of that shootout.
Although you never wish for anyone to miss a penalty in a shootout. That must be a terrible feeling. But then the positives, obviously, for the Palace side is that they kept the young, promising front line quite quiet. And, you know, there's two other experienced players in there, three other experienced players in there, Schneidlin, Schweinsteiger, and Mata within that midfield, with Herrera and Martial kind of in and around that. That competed against a midfield that you know, most people would say under any other manager but Pardew looks distinctly not like the kind of midfield that should be competing against that.
That's a very good point. We have to be careful to balance our criticism with praise, because Palace, I think, did play very well and probably were the team that was more deserving of a win. Draw probably seems appropriate. We're going to talk about our players of the week, some more results near the top of the table in the next segment. But first, let's take our first trip to Europe, where the last perfect team amongst UEFA's big leagues lost that label on Friday. No, Bayern Munich didn't lose in Bundesliga play, but at mid-table, Frankfurt München was drawn 0-0. They held 69% of the ball, but they only generated 10 shots. That meant that Dortmund, coming into the week 7 points back, gained ground after a 3-1 win at Werder Bremen, while Wolfsburg claimed third place with their 2-1 victory over Bayer Leverkusen, a victory that took advantage of Schalke's 1-1 draw with Ingolstadt. In Italy, the weekend's marquee match was at the San Siro, where league-leading Roma arrived looking to reproduce Fiorentina's feat of exploiting Roberto Mancini's attack-shy Inter. Instead, it was the Nerazzurri snaring an early goal, a Gary Medel 25-yard rocket, and holding on to go top of the table in Italy. On Sunday, they were joined by Fiorentina, whose 4-1 win over Frosinone put them on 24 points through 11 rounds. Roma is 1 point back, followed by Napoli in fourth, who stumbled to a 0-0 draw at mid-table Genoa. Lawrence, our players of the week, we only have two this week. I'm a little tempted to pick a random player of the week for Kartik, but let's go ahead and let him live in NASL peace for today. Let's start with you on this one. Who is your player of the week?
You do almost feel like that's how Kartik does it, isn't it? Well, I've got a dartboard, and I'm just going to throw a dart.
No.
This is a hard one. You know, I love my honourable mentions. Aruna Kone has got to be the mention, surely. Because of, I don't know, everyone, he was a great player on Porivo back when he signed for Wigan. And that was always very satisfying to play him, because he was refreshing as his approach. And you always hope that that is what would come when he was at Everton, because he looks like a wonderful complement to Romelu Lukaku.
Boy, and this weekend they were, but that tandem was great.
Exactly, it was just so satisfying to watch. And for him and the level of players that Martinez is working with there, you'd say Aruna Kone sums that up perfectly. And so the satisfaction that they must have about scoring against a team who sit, hold on a second. Second from bottom in the league, it's fantastic. It was a really great performance from him, to be fair to him, and it was just great to watch. Hat trick, and you'd argue, I think it was one assist, but maybe it should have been more within the game. It's more than says he's a good player, and more than says that he deserves to get this position this week.
Yeah, 3 goals and 1 assist. That's, you can just go on the score line for that one, or the stat line for that one. Although it was generally fun to watch that team in the second half. Lukaku, Gerard Deulofeu all had very influential games. You know, every once in a while, we pick a player of the week kind of as a point of privilege to highlight somebody that we've liked for a while. I'm going to go with somebody who maybe has been performing in the shadow of a couple of other breakout performers. There's a lot of focus on Jamie Vardy for Leicester, rightly so. A lot of focus on Riyad Mahrez. I'm going with Mark Albrighton this week. Albrighton has been consistently very good this year. And the two crosses that he put in for Riyad Mahrez today were just inch perfect. Really made Mahrez's job very easy. And I thought it was just the type of play that we've been seeing from Albrighton all year. We've seen Mahrez drop for a little bit in this team. We've seen other players come in and out. We've seen players like Gökhan Inler unable to nail down a spot in this team. There's a reason why Mark Albrighton is a consistent starter, because he is probably the most consistent player in this team. And this weekend, it paid off with two assists. So I'm going with him just as a way to highlight his performance. Let's go ahead and stick with Leicester. The story going into this game at West Brom was Tony Pulis. Tony Pulis, it seems like once every month or so, kind of comes out with these comments defending overlooked British managers. And this week it was saying that Claudio Ranieri was basically reaping the rewards of Nigel Pearson's work at Leicester. And I don't think that's completely unfounded, but it is kind of rude to bring that up when your team is facing Leicester this week. And in that way, I wasn't too disappointed to see Leicester get a 3-2 win over West Brom, a 3-2 win that was very characteristic of the different performances that we are seeing under Claudio Ranieri this year.
I just don't get what... I mean, I get what their point is. The point is, yes, this other person... what he's saying is this other person built the squad and therefore they should be reaping the rewards.
Yeah, but nobody was...
You had players who went to an orgy in the summer. You have the club was out of control under Pearson, not because of Nigel Pearson's construction of a squad. His ability to construct a squad is quite different from his ability to control that squad. And he was also, he was a bully within the press room. And there are a number of other reasons why Leicester didn't want him representing. Nothing to do. The problem is, and I think the Football Ramble summed it up perfectly not long ago, is you can get away with anything in football as long as you're a good football man.
Whatever
and
that,
it really helps you, whatever that means, you know? But yeah, but he loves his football.
Well, it seems like Tony Pulis has appointed himself like...
He's at home. He's not. Nigel Pearson didn't do that. But that, what I'm saying is, you know, that... You can't just get away with everything like that. And at the same time, they're not playing Pearson's football. They're playing much different football. Vardy looks like a much improved player, a player who's integrating skills that you'd argue that Pearson wouldn't have put to his game because Claudio Ranieri is playing him in not a completely different position, because he, of course, is not going to go from forward to left back, but it's a difference. No, so that's the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whereas last year we saw like Ulloa be the main goal scorer for this team, there is a greater freedom that he's allowed players like Jamie Vardy and Riyad Mahrez this year. It's just so weird that Tony Pulis has appointed himself kind of the advocate for the overlooked British manager, because
him and Sam Allardyce.
Yeah. So I just think it's very weird that you would volunteer for that role. Particularly when you're managing teams where you got to get your own house in order. I'm not saying that West Brom is a bad team, but they obviously have points to improve on. You're not speaking to these issues from some kind of high perch. It wasn't so long that Tony Pulis was let go by Stoke and essentially walked out on Crystal Palace. I don't know if that recent history really recommends him as somebody that should be appointing themselves the dean of British managers. But as far as the game is actually concerned, the scoreline looks typical Leicester, 3-2. The difference is this wasn't a come-from-behind effort by Leicester, although technically it was. They gave up the first goal. This was more of a complete performance than we're used to seeing from the Foxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, certainly so. And But then we mentioned it earlier in our analysis. Does one team make the other look good? Or was it just that they felt that the other side just didn't play up to the opportunities that they were given. And it's, you know, there are a lot of things that felt quite even in this game. And actually there were times where you felt that West Brom were in the ascendancy. And it maybe statistically in the way that, you know, they had more shots, or that they felt, I think they felt fairly equal in possession in this game. I don't have the stats in front of me, forgive me, but what I would say about that is then maybe it's partly the way that we watch Leicester and the way that Leicester almost lull aside into a false sense of security and then hit them. So, you know, it's playing defensively, it's drawing in someone and then counterpunching in a sense.
Yeah.
But we're obviously not watching Dortmund, but we're watching someone who is good at drawing the other team into the position they almost want them to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd say it takes a very conscious manager to set up and make his players aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And some people maybe become overconfident and get to the point where they think, well, we'll just hit them, and then they won't get back from that.
Yeah. That's been very characteristic of Leicester all year, and maybe that's why it's been a little bit difficult to figure them out with all of their comeback wins and their high scoring games. Ranieri has really enabled their team to look at games as opportunities, even when they fall behind, as they did today. The numbers,
sorry to cut you off, but I mean, if you believe that you want, I mean, that's an interesting one. And I'd love to know what Ranieri said about that. But if you believe that you need to get the other team into the point where they are in the ascendancy, or they feel they're in the ascendancy,
mm-hmm.
in order to achieve your best, then you almost need to get to a bad place to get good.
Yeah,
and I'm just wondering how much of that is applicable to what goes on at Leicester.
Yeah, there is something counterintuitive about that too. The
number—it's not always going to work. There are going to be times where you'll be bitten because you'll come up against a side who are able to just lock up or who have a good goalkeeping day.
And then maybe that explains why Leicester has been able to produce all these results, but against Arsenal, they were actually three goals behind them at the end of the game. The total shots were basically even, 14 to 13 for West Brom. Possession basically even, 52-48 for West Brom in that one. So actually a little more of the ball than we used to Leicester actually having. Let's go to Watford. 2-0 win over West Ham. West Ham's first loss of the Premier League since August 22nd. Wow. And Watford all year has seemed like a team. We've complimented their defense under Kike Sanchez Flores continuously. And West Ham, through Andy Carroll's error, gave up the first goal. And I guess in light of that, Lawrence, if you had told us that West Ham was going to give up the first goal, we wouldn't be too surprised that Watford would end up getting this result.
Yeah, I think it's partly down to when you have a powerful team and you say, well, I can see a win coming for them, but you never really say that for Watford. Because you don't class them within that, but you get the feeling that when they were to play a side like West Ham, then this was going to happen, if that makes sense. Yeah. Because of the way that they play, and I think you're right to point to that, and also the fact that there is some feeling of inconsistency around Bilic at times. And there's a number of managers who have come in more recently who their focus is on something that isn't, it's about getting the best out of players so that you can tactically play a game that requires you to be at the top of your tactical awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That a few years ago was not the case within the league, because we had managers who were more, they played towards the mean, if you like. Whereas I think managers now are playing more with the odds. And I think Bilic is definitely one of those, and so we'll see games like this.
Another pretty straightforward game, Southampton, 2-0 victory over Bournemouth. Ronald Koeman really did a lot during the week to play up the South Coast rivalry between these two sides, but two first-half goals.
What did he do? Did he put up a banner?
He just really seemed to be wanting to make Bournemouth cast them into that Portsmouth role, so to speak.
You're right.
It was a little bit uncomfortable, actually.
Bit weird, because you sort of feel like a foreigner sort of coming in and going, this is how we do rivalry, by the way.
Yeah, it kind of felt like a, you know, here in the States, we've had Major League Soccer really try to build up the rivalries between the teams. And sometimes they just pick two teams and you kind of scratch your head. It's like, I don't know. Did they really care about each other?
Yeah.
And that's how I felt about this one.
New York, hate people on the West Coast.
Exactly. You know? Like New York, LA rivalry. It's like, I'm not sure LA really cares about that much.
Exactly. Yeah. Unless, of course, we buy into 90s hip hop. But I think, there's also, and that it just feels quite, not rid, it just feels a little bit weird to have someone who you feel is not someone who you'd imagine is very good at reading those kind of things within culture. Tell you how to be culturally rivaled with someone else.
Yeah.
I find it quite funny. It's quite a funny, you imagine him sort of saying, I don't know, showing people a map and going, well, they are sort of close, so maybe we can, you know?
Because that's what rivalry is all about maps.
And rabble.
I think that Southampton is slowly developing into a team that we're kind of overlooking. They're putting together these consistent results. They're still hovering around 6th, 7th in the table. I think the one thing that differentiates them from Leicester and West Ham, Crystal Palace, teams that are around or above them in the table, is that Southampton has this track record at this point, specifically last season, that suggests that they are going to stay there, if not slightly improve, as this group of players continues to get healthy, come together, stop having random things happen to them.
As long as those random things don't happen to them.
Yeah, because random things never happen in football, right?
Really good point. They're level on points with Liverpool and Spurs at this point, and only one point ahead of Everton. It is incredible, really. There was a question on a live show that I normally do that I just hadn't happened to watch in the end. And one guy sort of called and floored the hosts when he said, what is it which separates the top of the Championship from the bottom of the Premier League? And then someone brought up Southampton, and it kind of floors everyone, doesn't it? Because they sort of go, well, oh yeah, but Southampton are an exception. And you think, well, why is Southampton the exception there? Why should they be the exception? And I'm sort of asking that question, is why are Southampton the exception in this?
Why do they
manage to leak players, you know?
Well, I guess that's probably what makes them the exception, because if we knew the answer to that, other clubs would be doing it and they would no longer be the exception.
Maybe other clubs are trying to do that, but failing at it.
Yeah, well, I think
it's just unusual that you know, Southampton, I mean, especially as a city, and you know, there's so many now centres of excellence closer to financial hubs, if you like. You wonder why it's Southampton that are managing to bring through so much youth, or managing to be so successful in finding these unpolished diamonds.
Very true. On Bournemouth, they have 1 point in their last five games, and they are only 1 point above the drop. Let's take our second trip to Europe here. Let's talk about Spain, where the big two have emerged alone at the top of the table. This week, Real Madrid and Barcelona preserved their 3 point gap on Celta Vigo, with Madrid claiming a 3-1 win over Las Palmas, while Barcelona posted a 2-0 victory at Getafe. For their part, Celta got an 89th minute golazo from Pablo Hernandez to claim a 3-2 win at David Moyes' Real Sociedad. Atletico's draw at Deportivo La Coruña means Diego Simeone's side falls 4 points back of first place. They're now even with Villarreal, who beat Sevilla 2-1 this weekend at El Madrigal. In France, because of the upcoming Champions League play this week, PSG played on Friday night, finally breaking through at Stade Rennes in the 75th minute through Angel Di Maria. And then after losses by Angers and Caen, PSG were left with a 10-point gap at the top of Ligue 1, with Lyon's four-match unbeaten run pushing LL into second place. So typically interesting French league football there. Got a couple.
They go away this week, don't they? That's going to be good.
Yes, it is.
Against Real Madrid is going to be a good game.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Champions League at the end of the segment, but maybe we can talk about that one a little bit, because that's going to be the marquee game again. I guess I don't necessarily believe that, given how Arsenal is playing. We'll talk about that in a second, though. Our top four is Lawrence. Mine are the same four teams as last week in both lists, although in a different order. On form, Arsenal is number one for me, followed by Spurs, Manchester City, and Leicester. And then at the end of the season, I have City, and then for the first time, I think, in 3 or 4 weeks, I have flopped 2 and 3. I have moved Arsenal ahead of Manchester United. Not necessarily because of anything Arsenal has done, because for a couple weeks now, I have been a believer that Arsenal is going to be better than what I thought they were going to be at the beginning of the season. I picked them fourth at the beginning of the season, but because Manchester United looks so bad. And if I had any inclination that Louis van Gaal was going to change things up in the coming weeks, I would still keep Manchester United too. But we're getting to the point where van Gaal is sticking with this lineup for long enough that these points dropped, and the effect that it has on bringing the team back to their peak once they finally make the move to correct it, it gives Arsenal the opening, I think, to pass Manchester United, at least in my mythical table in my head for end of the year. So I have Arsenal 2, Manchester United 3, followed by Spurs. Your two lists, Lawrence.
Hi, this is a good question, Richard. Man City sit up there. Leicester, mm-hmm. Manchester United don't get on there this week. They drop into fifth, and above them go Arsenal and Liverpool. Frustratingly, because actually, when I say that, you think, well, do Liverpool deserve to be on that list, considering the position of Chelsea? And really... Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks. So I'm probably going to say the coming end of the season will be City, Arsenal, United. And there's just from there was one article I read, I can't remember who it was by, but I think it was in The Guardian, and it basically said if Liverpool reach their peak under Klopp, they'll get fourth.
Yeah.
And it all just suddenly clicked for me. You know, if the effort matches what you believe their technical ability is, then you'd say Liverpool should definitely be in fourth place within the league.
Yeah, for me, it's a matter of when they reach that peak. I think they need to reach it by about February, I think. But I don't know why I say that, because they're even on points with Spurs right now. But Spurs likely go to 20 points after Monday's game against Aston Villa. But they're so close. I don't know why they couldn't reach their peak in April and then just go on a run to end the season and claim fourth place. So
it's also about the results against teams like Spurs, isn't it, I suppose?
True. Very
flat.
Yes. Let's talk about the one game that we haven't at this point, the two games that we haven't from the weekend. Everton 6-2 over Sunderland. We have talked about the performance from Everton when we were talking about player of the week. So let's talk about Sunderland a little bit. Sam Allardyce went to three at the back. Seemed to work for about 50 minutes, because after 50 minutes it was 2-2. And then Everton just exploded. Ultimately, when you give up six goals after changing your formation, it's a little bit difficult to justify the formation change.
Yeah, but he's still a tactical genius. Yes, in many ways. The good thing for them is they're attacking better. The bad thing for them is they just cannot defend. And it looks odd because Sam Allardyce normally is able to make his team line up and defend well. Mm-hmm. But with Sebastian Coates starting in the centre of that, obviously because of what happened with John O'Shea the week before, there are questions over how sturdy that back line could be.
Absolutely. The other match that we haven't talked about yet, Newcastle and Stoke, 0-0. Not very much to talk about here. Newcastle had a couple of chances to claim all 3 points. Ultimately, given how the bottom of the table is, Newcastle getting a point is pretty productive. They're now only 1 point behind Bournemouth, but neither of these teams looked very good. Stoke were outshot 15-9, had only 44% possession. They dropped Van Hinkle. Afellay's on the bench also. John Walters is starting at striker. The whole thing with Stoke, it just seems like Mark Hughes is starting to go to some security blankets, and this whole idea of Stoke Alona is being completely forgotten.
Or should just never have been brought up in the first place.
There you go. Thank you.
Maybe it's also that there are some players in there who feel Stoke is somewhat of a shop window.
That's a good point.
That's maybe disrespectful towards Stoke.
It is, but it's hard to see players like somebody on, like Van Hinkle on loan, who was in Italy last year, or Afellay really seeing it as anything else but a stepping stone, a temporary place to get their career back on track, so to speak.
It's also the way that you see them approach the games, or the way that they approach their fellow professionals in the match, where they almost... there's almost an air of disdain about the way that they approach other people within the game. Like, listen, I'm too good to be here, but I'm here for a little while. So while I'm here, just treat me like I'm one of the good players, and then you'll see, you know? That's the way it looks, at least.
Mm. Monday's game, Aston Villa visits White Hart Lane. Talked about Tottenham. With a victory, they claim fifth place from West Ham, puts 3 points between them and Liverpool. But let's talk about Aston Villa, because we've had a week to... have people more knowledgeable than us chime in on Remy Gard. And I actually learned a lot this week, because what I remembered of Gard was basically him being brought in at Lyon at the same time that their president wanted to downsize and go with the youth movement. Even in that context, I was not very impressed. I thought he still had players to do better than he did. But a lot of people writing this week saying that other people felt differently, specifically the people at Lyon, and that Remy Gard would come to Aston Villa with a level of respect for what he did at Lyon.
Yeah, although you would also say that football has changed very significantly since he was at Lyon. Hmm. This just seems to have been revolutions in the way that managers seem to be approaching it, although maybe that's good for him, because it means that he will have been away and had time to write these things up and think about them, and you know, so you'd hope that he can implement something that's going to change. It slightly smacks of we lacked options and therefore we weren't with, and you just sort of hope that that's not the way that the press approach him. And that there's an air of respect around God.
Yeah, well, maybe like we talked about last week, it might have been worth changing from Sherwood just because of the sure baggage and emotional nature of Sherwood at this point. Champions League this week. Let's start on Tuesday. The last time Manchester United scored a goal, it was in Russia from Anthony Martial against CSKA Moscow. CSKA
is at
Old Trafford. Yes, it is. It's 305 minutes away. CSKA is at Old Trafford. This game screams to me as an opportunity for Manchester United against a decent team, but at home against a team they got a result from in Russia, a time for them to bounce back, Lawrence. With the quick turnaround too, this gives them an opportunity to actually sit Rooney. The question is whether they'll actually do that, and if they do, will it even matter?
Good question, Richard. Probably. That's what I'm wondering, is without Wayne Rooney, if they then lose, what happens? Like, does Wayne Rooney almost feel like a Manchester United safety blanket to you?
I don't know. I don't know what Wayne Rooney feels like right now. I just can't. I can't remember the last time this situation came up where there was a player that just was performing so poorly and he seemed undroppable. I just can't remember it.
The difference is, I think Rooney may, in this game, play a little deeper.
Interesting.
I think that's what he did against CSKA. So I remember if he plays deeper, that only really gives him the option up top of Martial.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Lingard, but that feels like you're starting someone who's not very experienced within that area. Although he did obviously did play again against ESK, which is why I would say he should play. So I would say Rooney will start deeper and Manchester United will look to be more aggressive towards them, obviously because they're at home. I think that's how it's going to play out. I think United will get the win. I think they'll look not comfortable, but I think it'll look a lot more dominant than we're used to seeing United.
Manchester City is at Sevilla on the same day. Juventus is going to be at Mönchengladbach at that time. It seems like an opportunity for Manchester City to take the top of the table. That would mean probably claiming 3 points, beating a Sevilla team that seems like could give them trouble in this one.
Yeah, although you'd say, you know, they only beat them 2-1 last time out. But again, though, I do feel like since that game, we've seen City go through maybe some more difficult games. So we've seen them go through the Manchester Derby.
They've also got Kompany back, too. And we talked about how big Kompany is for them all season. And the pairing between him and Otamendi looks potentially great.
And but also the 5-1 thrashing of Crystal Palace. That was a fairly comprehensive win. So for that reason, I'm going to put City ahead in this one and say that they built on what they last did against Sevilla and hope that therefore they get the result.
Yeah, one thing I didn't mention in our Bundesliga diatribe is that Gladbach won again this weekend, 4-1. I believe that's 6 wins in a row. So that is not going to be an easy trip at all for Juventus. Let's go to Wednesday's game. Let's go to one of Wednesday's game because I can't deal with more Chelsea talk. Dynamo Kiev is going to be at Stamford Bridge. Basically, if Chelsea plays like Chelsea, they're going to win this one. If they play like current Chelsea, who knows what's going to happen? It could be another draw. Yeah. Let's concentrate on the big game on Wednesday, Bayern Munich against Arsenal. This really seems like a point where Arsenal can capitalize on their win against Bayern Munich before, play even better, because for most of that game, it looked like they were going to eventually lose that game. But they didn't. They've only lost one game, I believe, in the last, 3 weeks, and that game being the Sheffield Wednesday game. At the same time, it is such a big ask, even though Bayern did draw on Friday, to go to the Allianz Arena and get a result. Arsenal still needs it, though. They only have 3 points through 3 games in this group.
So, yeah, so there's a sense of belief around what Arsenal can do there. You'd also say that I think Pep Guardiola is fairly magnanimous in the way that Arsenal won. You just sort of wonder whether it's so for that reason he's sort of thinking, yeah, well, if we continue to play the way that we did, then we probably would have got the win. Mm-hmm. And I think that may be telling. Bayern are fairly undeniable at the moment. Even in that game where they lost to Arsenal, they still felt fairly undeniable. And you'd say that it was small margins for them. So I still think Bayern have got this one. Although I'd love to see Arsenal do it.
Yeah, well, let me summarize the stakes here for Arsenal. Arsenal is bottom of Group F with 3 points, even on points with Dinamo Zagreb, but they lose the head-to-head tiebreaker at this point in time. Olympiacos and Bayern tied at the top of the table with 6 points. What Arsenal really needs is for Zagreb to get some points off Olympiacos. Assuming that Arsenal loses, and that's an assumption that might not come true, but if they lose and Olympiacos wins, they're going to be 6 points behind both Bayern and Olympiacos, and they're already losing that tiebreaker to Olympiacos. They would need to win out, hope Olympiacos doesn't claim any more points. It's definitely possible because Olympiacos' last 2 games after their match against Zagreb on Wednesday are against Bayern and Arsenal, but the odds are so thin at that point. Arsenal really needs to get at least a point against Bayern on Wednesday.
Yeah, which is possible. So I was only really saying that Arsenal would not be able to win that, but you wonder about a draw there.
With a draw, if Arsenal draws and then they win at home against Zagreb and in Greece, they're probably through at second place, provided that Olympiacos doesn't beat Bayern in their game. So it's not the most outlandish scenario. However, if they lose to Munich, then they're in a situation where Olympiacos only needs to pick up 1 point against Bayern or Arsenal, and Arsenal still has to be perfect, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of it gets a lot simpler for Bayern if Zagreb beats Olympiacos on Wednesday. And that is Wednesday. We will not be coming to you midweek, as we've done in the past. We will be coming back to you on Sunday when the 12th match of the Premier League season is in the books. But until then, for the absent Kartik Krishnar, I'm Richard Farley. Lawrence?
Enjoy your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is produced by Christopher Harris and Richard Farley and is a production of worldsoccertalk.com. For more information on the show, Check us out at worldsoccertalk.com or subscribe through our iTunes feed. You can follow World Soccer Talk on Twitter at World Soccer Talk or follow the show's hosts. Lawrence McKenna is at Lawscast, Kartik Krishnar is at KKFLA737, and I'm at Richard Farley.